Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's Asia tour to Pakistan, India, and China. The three states that he visited are the most important great powers in mainland Eurasia east of Iran, and his visit to those three countries proved that Saudi Arabia is capable of maintaining a delicate balancing act between them. Pakistan is a decades-long strategic partner of the kingdom, but its rival India and top ally China are relatively new ones, which is why his trip to those other two was so important as well. The Crown Prince signed different deals with each of them that altogether prove that Saudi Arabia is expanding its strategic reach to the east and is eager to establish a major presence there on par with what is simultaneously doing in Africa. Unlike in years past, this effort isn't being led by religious proselytizers, but businessmen, confirming that the Crown Prince is moving beyond his country's contentious legacy of spreading Wahhabism as a fifth column of influence and is instead focusing mostly on state-to-state relations. Not only is this occurring on a bilateral basis, but it also has hints of a multilateral one as well. MBS visited India after Pakistan, though following a brief stopover in Riyadh for protocol's sake at the reported insistence of his Indian host, which coincided with his foreign minister declaring his kingdom's desire to mediate between the two in the context of the current Kashmir crisis. Even though subsequent reports denied that MBS would directly fulfill this role, it's still very symbolic that his country is committing its diplomats to this task. In addition, Saudi Arabia's investment deals with India also show that it doesn't discriminate against regional partners and has a stake in it and Pakistan's stability, thus reaffirming its interest in mediating between them. South Asia is simply too close to West Asia and the source of so many labor migrants to the latter that Saudi Arabia can't ignore it, especially when its burgeoning population presents enormous market opportunities for the kingdom's future Vision 2030 exports. As for the final Chinese leg of this world tour, it should be pointed out that Saudi Arabia signed tens of billions of dollars worth of deals with the People's Republic in 2017, and that Beijing is a firm proponent of MBS's Vision 2030 socioeconomic reform initiative. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia's $20 billion investment in Pakistan complements China's CPEC strategy of turning the South Asian state into its gateway to the Mideast and beyond. Taken together, MBS's Asia tour successfully positioned his country as the common partner linking together Eurasia's three most important continental great powers east of Iran, a crucial geopolitical role that will surely become more significant by the year. The next one up is Facebook imposing double standards to censor popular Russia-connected pages. The US-based social media platform removed several pages managed by Mavic Media, a company partly owned by RT subsidiary Ruptly, on the alleged basis that they were misleading their audience about their connections to Russia. The company's CEO, Anissa Nawari, suggested that CNN was tipped off about this beforehand by a US government-funded think tank that helped coordinate this infowar operation, decrying what she described as a loophole that allows for state censorship. Facebook, for its part, claims that it's trying to improve so-called transparency on its site by rolling out new standards behind the scenes that have yet to go live or be implemented in full. In principle, and provided that Facebook is telling the truth, the idea is sound enough, though only if it's universally applied and done so without discriminating against anyone in particular like Mavic Media, which regrettably wasn't the case in this instance. The US government seems to have been working indirectly through one of its many, partially funded think tanks in order to coordinate this infowar operation while retaining so-called plausible deniability in the face of Anissa's censorship claims. The selective enforcement of transparency standards speaks to the fact that the US wants to send an intimidating message to all alternative media outlets that they could be next. That in and of itself is a dystopian thought to countenance, but the larger issue at play is the topic of cyber sovereignty and whether non-US-based users, including companies, have any universal rights on American platforms, which they seemingly do not. As disturbing as it may be, there's practically nothing that anyone can do to ensure the fair and equal application of Facebook's ever-changing rules, including secret ones that have yet to be publicly announced, like the excuse that was used to censor Mavic's pages, nor any recourse to rely upon whenever this doesn't happen. Simply put, victims of injustice are literally out of luck. Thankfully, however, Mavic isn't just any random company, but has created content that generated over 2.5 billion views and had tens of millions of subscribers. Furthermore, Anissa was able to utilize her professional contacts with RT to draw global attention to what happened, thereby putting pressure on Facebook to address the situation, unlike how they might have otherwise ignored it had she not been able to successfully do this. No matter what ultimately happens and whether or not Facebook ever impartially imposes new so-called transparency standards all across the board, including with regards to US government-linked entities, it nevertheless established a dark precedent by censoring Mavic Media. Third on our countdown is the US's insistence that the EU take back its terrorist citizens from Syria. Trump wants the U.S.'s NATO partners to repatriate their citizens captured during anti-terrorist operations in areas of Syria under his proxy's control, whether to put them on trial in their homelands or reintegrate them into society depending upon their sovereign choice. This demand has been met with strong opposition from those countries who are fearful of the public's reaction to spending taxpayer funds on these controversial efforts when it wouldn't cost anything to let them languish for the rest of their lives in the Mideast. The rising popular sentiment in the continent has made it difficult for even the most euro-liberal of governments, like the one in Germany, to implement its infamous principles, something that the US is certainly well aware of and eager to exploit for political ends. All the rhetoric about so-called human rights, freedom, and justice aside, the US and its regional partners could easily just kill the terrorist suspects or let them remain forever imprisoned in a desert dungeon. But Trump wants to trumpet his democratic credentials by giving these suspects a supposedly fair chance for their future by leaving their destinies up to their governments. Barring that, he ominously hinted on Twitter that these individuals could be released from custody and would, as he put it, permeate Europe, thus putting the EU on the horns of an unprecedented dilemma whereby it either submits to the US's demands, contrary to its people's popular sentiment, or endangers its citizens' security by letting the US release those suspects and risk them returning to their home countries to carry out terrorist attacks. Either way, it's a lose-lose scenario for the EU, which Trump masterfully manipulated it into as revenge for standing up to him over the past 2 years. The president is already well aware of his country's terrible reputation abroad, so he doesn't care all that much about people cynically accusing it of letting terrorists return to the EU. He can always disingenuously claim that the US doesn't have full control over its proxies and can't control what they'll do with the prisoners if they aren't repatriated, nor can it commit troops to guarding their detention facilities indefinitely. Basically, the US is signaling that these fighters aren't its problem or its responsibility anymore, and that the EU can either responsibly take them into custody or they'll find their way back home, regardless. One way or another, the US is indirectly encouraging the spread of populist anti-government sentiment in Europe just months before the bloc's parliamentary elections in May, with this being strategically intended to tip the continental balance against the ruling Western European Euro-liberals and towards the upstart Euro-realist in Southern and Central Europe. It was a matter of coincidence that the timing of these requested terrorist repatriations turned out to be so auspicious, but that nevertheless doesn't mean that the US isn't weaponizing it for its own purposes. As they say, where there's a will, there's a way, and Trump's proving that he'll do whatever is needed to take revenge in the EU for going against his trade and security policies, even if it means facilitating terrorist re-entry into the bloc. Our runner-up is the cancellation of the planned Visegrad 4 summit in Israel. The four Central European Euro-realist countries of Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic were supposed to gather together in Israel until Netanyahu and his new foreign minister ruined the occasion and made it politically impossible to do so. The Israeli premier was in the Polish capital last week for a US-organized Mideast summit, during which time he walked the line of possibly breaking last year's new Polish law by allegedly accusing the entire nation of collaborating with the Nazis. He denied that he meant such a thing in his off-camera remarks and instead blamed Israeli media for misreporting his words, though Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki declined to attend the planned Visegrad meeting because of the scandal and said he'd send his foreign minister instead. Everything soon thereafter fell apart, however, after new Israeli foreign minister Yisrael Katz shockingly said that, quote, every Pole suckled anti-Semitism with his mother's milk, end quote, which prompted Poland to immediately demand an apology, but which instead resulted in the Czech Republic announcing that the summit would be canceled and replaced by bilateral talks instead. Katz's remark was the epitome of racism, because it implied that hateful ideologies like anti-Semitism are ingrained in an ethnic group's genes and passed down to every generation. A completely false notion, but one whose variation in one way or another was nevertheless used against Jews for centuries to justify discrimination, pogroms, and ultimately genocide. Poles have also been the scapegoats of racist abuse for centuries, and it's very painful to once again be reminded of this by none other than the Israeli foreign minister, who, as the top diplomat of Israel, should understand exactly what this sort of ethnic hatred could lead to. It's true that Poles and Jews share a very complex history with one another, but it's nevertheless a common one that should have brought them closer together in the present day, instead of ripped them further apart. After all, both of their governments had recently restored relations to such an excellent level that the first ever Visegrad 4 summit outside of Europe was supposed to take place in Israel. Poland and its institutional partners, be they those from the Visegrad 4 or the broader Warsaw-led Three Seas Initiative all across Central Europe, believe that they have more civilizational commonalities with Israel than their Euro-liberal Western European counterparts do, especially given the latter's recent acceptance of large-scale migration from civilizationally dissimilar global South states, to say nothing of their close political ties with Israel's nemesis, Iran. This scandal could therefore jeopardize that to both parties' strategic detriment, even if it serves the short-term goal of their domestic political benefit by helping Netanyahu win re-election in early April and Poland's Euro-realist come out on top in May's European parliamentary elections if both of them leverage this incident to appeal more to their base. At our top spot, we got the Chicago police charging Jussie Smollett with a felony. The famous homosexual African-American actor claimed to be the victim of a grisly hate crime last month when he alleged that two MAGA hat-wearing men assaulted him late at night during a walk home, called him homophobic and racial slurs, yelled that this is MAGA country, poured bleach on him, and even tied a noose around his neck. Smollett's story immediately went viral, and everyone from the mainstream media to President Trump condemned it in the strongest possible terms, though it now turns out that the two suspects who police just interviewed supposedly said that the actor paid them to pull off what basically amounts to a false flag hate crime pinned on Trump supporters in order to generate nationwide sympathy and avoid being written off of his TV show. As incredulous as it sounds, media reports say that one of the two Nigerian brothers actually worked with Smollett as an extra and purchased the rope that the self-professed victim says was tied around his neck. Commentators had begun poking holes in Smollett's story ever since he refused to hand over his unredacted cell phone records from the night of the alleged attack, plus the fact that police weren't called until at least over half an hour after Smollett said that the incident occurred, both of which were extremely suspicious actions of someone who just experienced a 21st century lynching in the unofficial hometown of America's first black president. As a result of this, and perhaps other currently undisclosed evidence, police charged Smollett with one felony count of disorderly conduct for filing a false police report. As bad as this possible conspiracy may sound, it could have been worse if it was caught on camera. Breitbart's editor-at-large, John Nolte, wrote earlier this week about the chain of events that could have unfolded had a nearby surveillance camera faced the other way and filmed the incident, predicting that, to quote his article, once police had the footage, it would leak. Once cable and network news had the footage, it would loop endlessly. The fact that the two brothers are black wouldn't matter. CBS Chicago reports that a black face mask was found in their apartment. Smollett told police the attackers wore face masks, with those face masks the organized left, the media, Democrat celebrities, were allowed to assume his racist attackers were white. End quote. In other words, this possibly staged attack could have been exploited to incite racial tensions and smear all Trump supporters as racist, homophobic lynchers. It remains to be seen whether the media's scandalous reports about Smollett potentially paying two African immigrants, one of whom he might have known from work, to pull off a racist and homophobic hate crime against him are true or not, but if they are, then he should be condemned by everyone who previously supported him and found guilty in the court of law for what would in that case be his shameful self-promotional stunt designed to save his job. The actor should, of course, be presumed to be innocent until proven guilty, and the media might have just gotten the latest twist in this entire story totally wrong, but then again, it could also be that the media was so eager to spread his original story that they didn't bother to scrutinize the suspicious facts. Alright folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as always, do want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program, and I hope you all tune in again next week. Thank you, have a nice rest of your week, and take care. Bye.